Welcome to Side Podcast episode 36, and then there were three. Coming up in a bit, we've got the first ever Side Podcast interview.
Yay!
But first up, we've got a quick roundup of the news stories that have happened this week. McLaren have decided to drop both their appeals.
That is a shame. No retribution for the stewards in Hungary. And that means Ferrari are absolutely 100% 2007 Constructors champions.
You can see why, though. They're probably just fed up with this year.
Yeah.
Want to, you know, put this year behind them.
Get on with it. Get on with 2008.
The FIA transcripts were released, and they had lots of juicy information in them, perhaps a little bit too much.
You reckon?
Because they gave the documents to the teams first so they could blank out any information they didn't want the general public to see. But then when they released the information to everybody, you could still find out the secret stuff.
You could copy and paste it and then just see everything within it, yeah.
Not the smartest thing the FIA have ever done.
They moved very quickly to retract the information and put up the correct documents.
But not quickly enough, though. We still found out how much Mike Coughlin earns.
Oh, yeah. We did do a thorough analysis of each document. Even you read it, didn't you?
I read both of them all the way through. I'm so impressed with myself.
And if you look on the blog, we've done a really thorough analysis of all the interesting juicy bits within there. Probably not worth repeating them, though, because we'd just be reading our own blog out loud.
The 2008 calendar has changed slightly. Italy and Belgium have swapped places, and Japan and China have swapped places. No one's really saying why, but presumably it's just a date issue.
Yeah, or it could be transportation. Might be easier to get from one to the other that way. No big deal. No big change.
This week was an exciting week of testing, and I say exciting, I mean dull.
No! It was an important week of testing, because it was the last testing of the 2007 season.
But nothing happened. It was pretty dull.
No, lots of teams tried out some 2008 parts, and consequently went very slow.
The only interesting bit was Honda turning up with a McLaren-style nose.
They're all at it now, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. All the teams were there at the test except Spyker and Super Aguri. On the first day, Timo Glock went quickest in the BMW, Liuzzi was second fastest, and Buemi in the Red Bull was third. So obviously the top teams were running 2008 things. On day two, De La Rosa was fastest, with Webber and Badoa in the Ferrari behind him. Interestingly, Liuzzi was driving for Toro Rosso for most of the day. Vettel turned up, did one lap, and went home.
He was just getting his eye in for the next day.
Just one lap.
Yeah.
And on the third day, De La Rosa again fastest with Badoa and Webber behind him.
And nothing else happened on that day of any interest whatsoever?
Nope.
So you're right, it wasn't a very interesting test, was it?
Nope. That's enough news. As promised, here comes our first ever Side Podcast interview. Because it's our first, we're playing around with all the bits and pieces, trying to make it work. So I hope it sounds okay. And let us know what you think and if you'd like to hear more. Today we're joined by a very special guest. He runs the always up to the minute website F1 Fanatic, which is packed with plenty of news and views, Keith Collentine. Hi, Keith.
Hi there, thanks for having me on the show.
Keith, give us a bit of a background about yourself. How long have you been into F1?
Oh, wow. I started watching Formula One when I was, in shorts. I was about 8 years old, and I watched Nigel Mansell in the Ferrari back in those days. And I've never really stopped watching it. So since sort of 1989, 1990, really, and started F1 Fanatic 2 years ago. It became a blog at the start of last year, and it's grown from there.
What was it before it was a blog?
It was just kind of an ordinary website, really, that just had Formula One pictures, some bits of news. Wasn't really very up to date, I would say. I sort of only updated it once a week, and then I had the idea of turning it into a blog, and it's grown from there.
And apart from that, you also are involved in Auto Trader, aren't you?
Yeah, well, I work for Auto Trader. That's my day job, and more. And I write a weekly column on that called Trackside, which is about all kinds of motor racing, not just Formula One. And I write for a magazine there as well.
So we can consider you our official expert.
Yeah.
So this might be a tough question, but why are you an F1 fan? What do you like about it?
Wow. I mean, when I first started watching the sport, obviously, what got me going was, patriotism as much as anything else, because you watch Nigel Mansell and he was doing all these astonishing things, particularly in the Ferrari years. I got into it then, and plus you had back then the Senna-Prost fight, which was an amazing thing, a rivalry not like you've seen in many other sports. and, you know, great racing and all the rest of it. And what keeps me watching now is pretty much the same. I mean, yeah, anyone who's read the website will know I gripe about the quality of racing in F1 quite a lot, but it still can be great on its day, you know, and we've seen even races recently that have been spellbinding, like the Japanese Grand Prix back in 2005 is a great example. And everything else about it, you know, is the icing on the cake. I mean, it's been hard to be an F1 fan over the past week or so because the sport's been beating itself up quite thoroughly. But at the end of the day, you've still got 22 phenomenal drivers in the most incredible cars in the world that go at incredible speeds. And if you go and stand, you know, somewhere like Beckett's at Silverstone or Blanchimont at Spa, it's impossible not to be a Formula One fan. And I've just come back from my first ever visit to the Italian Grand Prix at Monza. And you know, people say it's an almost spiritual experience, and it's an incredible place to watch F1 racing. And I felt like much more of an F1 fan after coming back from that.
That's good to hear. Going back to what you were just saying about experiencing Senna versus Prost, how does that compare? Because that was kind of almost before my time, so I don't have a huge amount of experience of what was going on then. How does that compare now to Alonso versus Hamilton?
Well, first of all, you have to understand, when Senna and Prost were racing each other, I was 8 years old. So really, I only followed what was going on the circuit. But when you see one driver ramming into another at 160 miles an hour and taking him off the track, you don't need to pick up the subtleties so much. You know that things aren't going too well there. And really, what I've learned of it since then, you know, I've read by reading, you know, the magazines and stuff like Joe Ramirez's book, which is very enlightening about the Senna Prost thing. So it's a bit hard for me to say how it compares to Alonso Hamilton. But in many ways, you can see the similarities. I mean, there's, you know, Alonso almost in the Prost role, you know, already a 2-time champion. Not underestimating what his new young teammate was capable of, but certainly being taken aback when Hamilton gave him the kind of hard time that he has. But what's been interesting is Alonso's reaction, perhaps like Prost's, has been to take the political route, in Alonso's case, trying to force Ron Dennis, apparently, into giving him absolute number one status at McLaren, which is perhaps a rather naive thing for Alonso to try and do. Whereas the Prost and Senna battle ended up in a confrontation on the track and the two hitting each other on several occasions, you have to wonder if that's what's going to be the next thing with the Alonso-Hamilton battle. And if that does happen, and here's the interesting extra dimension, if that does happen, it will probably let one of the Ferrari drivers through to be world champion.
If that does happen, do you see the FIA stepping in?
You know, ordinarily I would say no, but I think in the light of the past few weeks, you wouldn't rule out the FIA stepping in on anything. You know, if someone sneezes out of place and the FIA are going to step in. Having said that, if I could just actually qualify that remark and add something else to it, one thing that I had an F1 fanatic recently was some interesting remarks that Max Mosley made in James Allen's new book, where he was saying that under modern rules, if Michael Schumacher or someone would to have done something similar to what Schumacher did to Hill in 1994, the FIA might step in and strip them of their championship.
Yes.
So, yeah, perhaps they would step in, and if, in some hypothetical scenario, one of the drivers took off the other and won the championship, perhaps the FIA would get their hands dirty and take the driver's championship off someone and give it to someone else. I mean, after all, one might argue they've done something very similar with the Constructors' Championship this year.
That's true. They do have more evidence. The FIA has more to draw upon these days with the electronics in cars.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
So they would have an easier job of proving it than maybe they did with Michael.
Absolutely.
So apart from the espionage thing, how do you think this season compares with previous ones?
Well, let's look at the good things, first of all. I mean, we have had a stunning battle for the Drivers' Championship. There have not been many seasons where this late in the day there are still four drivers mathematically capable of winning the championship. Realistically, now we're down to three. I mean, Felipe Massa is going to need a fair slice of luck to win the driver's title. But still, we've got three excellent drivers in very, very good cars still fighting for the Drivers' Championship. That's the good thing. Obviously, on the negative side of it, we've already discussed the espionage scandal at length, and I'm sure we've got more stuff to say on that later. Aside from that, you have to say the quality of the racing this year has been generally dismal. I mean, we had lots of fun at the Nürburgring when it rained. F1 races are always good when it rains on them. and apart from that, the Canadian Grand Prix was fairly exciting, although, you know, marred by all the fear over what happened to Kubica. And apart from that, you have to look and say, you know, F1 really needed a great race at Belgium last year at a fantastic venue, and it didn't get it.
No.
It was really quite turgid.
You know, you've heard of the overtaking working group. Do you think it's going to solve any of these problems, or do you think it's just another kind of distraction?
Well, I'm hopeful. Certainly, reading what's been reported in the press about it, particularly in Autosport, what they're saying has been received fairly well. People like Pat Simmons, for example, spoke very highly of what they'd come out with. Exactly what they're going to suggest, or at least they seem to have suggested various things, including limiting or perhaps creating a spec underbody for the cars. In order to generate a certain amount of ground effect downforce, and then limiting what the teams can put on the surfaces of the cars to create further downforce, and thus you'll get less of the buffeting in the corners. That sounds promising. They've also spoken about taking off the little winglets, all these little appendages that have been growing on the cars mainly over the past sort of 5 years around the bargeboard areas and in front of the rear wing. They're talking about banning those completely. That would, I suspect, although I'm not an expert, also reduce the aerodynamic sensitivity of the cars. What we have heard of, and I'm not sure, forgive me if I'm misleading you here, if this has come out of the overtaking working group or not, but the FIA have talked about things like having wings that extend under certain circumstances to give one driver more grip.
Yes.
I have to be sceptical about that sort of thing because it sounds very difficult to create in the first place. And secondly, and perhaps more importantly, it sounds completely unnecessary. And what always gets me with the overtaking argument is that the FIA have a perfect case study in how to make single-seater cars race each other properly. And it races at pretty much every Grand Prix weekend. It's called GP2. And they have big slick tyres, which in the longer length race they have to change once, and invariably there are drivers trying to nurse a badly damaged set of tyres at the end of the race. They have very, very small and tightly controlled wings that they can't add much downforce to at all, and it is always a recipe for great racing. And trying to mimic that in Formula One, bringing in slick tyres, which surely they can do now that we're down to a spec tyre, and reducing the wing size seems to me the really obvious way to go. And that, rather than these slightly pie-in-the-sky solutions of wings that magically change shape at certain speeds, would surely be the better way to go.
The issue they have with bringing in those wings is monitoring how and when they're used. Because as I understand the proposal, I think you're right in that it has come from the overtaking working group. There's going to be an FIA spec, I guess, pitot tube on the front of the car, which will monitor when it's behind a car, and then adjust the wings. Now, you know the problem they have in validating and keeping up with things like traction control. Is it not just adding another thing that they're not going to be able to monitor correctly and prove?
It certainly seems that way, yeah. I mean, I can't imagine how they're going to do that. I mean, if they don't know when, say, teams are using flexible floors that move in ways that the FAA aren't aware about, which is something else that's come out of the SB9 thing, then I can't for one second imagine how they're going to manage that. Yeah, I mean, I think they're biting off more than they can chew with it. You know, they're just creating yet more difficult regulations to enforce that are going to have a questionable impact on the quality of the racing. And yeah, could just lead to more sticky situations of the like we've been mired in for the past months.
One thing that's apparent in GP2 is the single-spec chassis. So if you're saying that GP2 offers better racing, are you therefore implying that Formula One should adopt a single chassis?
That's a very good question. I mean, yeah, you're quite right. Very often the argument about how to improve racing in Formula One ends up becoming an argument about Formula One wouldn't be Formula One if it were a spec series. And there's always a balance to be struck. And I think perhaps what the overtaking working group have suggested in terms of making the underbodies of the cars all the same, i.e. the bit that you can't see unless something's gone horrendously wrong, making that bit the same to improve the racing and yet let the teams have more a greater degree of control over the upper surface of the car is perhaps a good compromise.
How do you think the four-race gearbox rule is going to affect things next year?
I think Red Bull are screwed.
Definitely.
That's pretty much the sum total of my thoughts on it. All the other teams, perhaps Honda accepted as well, don't seem to have had that great problems with their gearboxes these days, and I would expect that they're able to make them last for four races. Others, principally Red Bull, have had big problems, and I'd be very concerned. The big thing they've got to redress for next year is reliability, and this is yet one more challenge for them. And then again, on top of that, you know, I have to add, it's always disappointing to see situations where drivers are being disadvantaged in terms of grid position when their car lets them down. And if we're going to have the case where, you know, say a driver turns up at the Australian Grand Prix and his gearbox fails, he's then dropping a certain number of grid places for the next three races, that's pretty poor.
Bringing us back to this season, earlier this week the FIA's transcripts were released. What's your feelings about the newfound transparency from the FIA?
Oh, well, I mean, you have to welcome the FIA releasing all these documents. And even if, as some people have said, it doesn't necessarily show them in the best light. I mean, it did appear to be a very hurried hearing. But no, I think it's great. Sunlight is the best disinfectant. And I think F1 could use a dose more of it. And I think we were talking earlier on about things like the Prost Senna years. And one thing you certainly didn't have in those days was this kind of transparency from the FIA. So I think it's definitely a good thing, and it's a step forward for the sport. And it's great to see everyone, particularly on the blogs, you know, really getting in there and scrutinising the documents very deeply. One thing I will say is that, you know, talking at this time, and obviously this is Saturday when we're doing this interview now, and I think the podcast goes up a little bit later, but at this stage, there hasn't been an enormous amount of analysis of the hearing transcripts within the wider media. And certainly the story about the FIA accidentally releasing an improperly censored copy of the documents that had a lot of the secret information in it doesn't appear to have been picked up on any of the major news sites at all, which really surprises me.
That is an interesting point, actually. I did see it on one non-Formula One site, and that source linked to your site.
Right. Which site was that?
A site called The Register.
I think it's
an IT website, and they were talking about the leaking of documents on the internet, and it's like, you know, as an IT angle, information security and that kind of thing. And they didn't link to any official news source at all, because there isn't one. Your site was the only site running it.
Yeah, I'm still waiting for the FIA goons to beat me up.
But you're not doing anything wrong.
As far as I'm aware.
The FIA have made a good start with the transcripts, but they sort of lose context. Sometimes they refer to something that's going on in the room. Do you think they should do more, like video the hearing and then release that to the public as well?
I think there is scope for expanding what they've done with the hearing documents. And like you say, giving more detail about what's going on in the room would be a step forward. Perhaps they could do something in terms of letting people see some of the documents that were circulated. I mean, lots of references are made to particular pieces of evidence that obviously those of us who have obtained the hearing documents can't see. So at least, you know, giving an index of what they were or giving some indication of what they are would be helpful. In terms of videoing it, yeah, they could do. But really, realistically, I don't think there's going to be an enormous amount of demand to watch a nine-hour hearing from the FIA. I really don't want to stare at Max Mosley and Ron Dennis's faces for that long. What I would say, I mean, you know, all the scripts are out there now. It's surely only a matter of time until someone acts it out and puts it on YouTube.
Is there anything else you noticed from the transcripts?
Like you've said, and like you've made a point about on the blog, one thing that strikes you is that there's a constant need to hurry things along, and they were constantly saying, you know, we need to get ready because people have got to get flights and things like that. That was surprising, given the severity of what was going on and the enormity of the punishment that was later handed out. You know, I've sat in plenty of meetings wishing to hurry people along, but I've never sat in a meeting probably quite as important as that one. And I was surprised to see that. And I don't think that necessarily shows the sport's governing processes in the best possible light. Perhaps they should have taken more time.
Was it a wise decision to hold the hearing the day before a race weekend?
On the surface of it, you'd say not. I mean, you have to take into account that there are a lot of people in that room with very, very major demands on their time. I mean, taking Max Mosley as an example, managing Formula One is just one of the many, many jobs he has to do. So getting the people together for any length of time is difficult. But perhaps there's lessons here for the FIA to learn in terms of how they prosecute these things, and, you know, whether they needed quite as many people in the room, and whether there's more efficient ways of handling this kind of hearing.
There seemed to be a rumour that Hamilton's performance on Friday and then further on Saturday and Sunday was affected by the fact he had to fly from Paris to Belgium.
Yeah, well, of course, that was his choice. I mean, Fernando Alonso didn't do that.
Yes, true.
And he said five words.
He did only say five words. Do you think it was necessary for him to be there? Did he add anything to that, to the hearing?
Lewis Hamilton. I don't think it, from the point of view of McLaren's case, I don't think it was necessary at all. From the point of view of Lewis Hamilton's career, I think it's a very astute move.
The next question should be whether or not F1 has been hindered by this. I heard it's gone down quite well in America, and it's raised the awareness and profile of F1 over there as a result of this.
It's a very tricky thing to judge so soon after it's happened. I'm very interested by your remarks that it's apparently gone down well or has created publicity in America. In America, I think they love their sporting scandals. I mean, you look at the kind of stuff that goes on in NASCAR, they seem to be forever banning pit crews for this and that, little transgressions. There's always a lot of stuff that you may or may not call cheating going on. And then you look at their other sports, say, you know, baseball, for example. You had the Barry Bonds drugs controversies and so on. So perhaps it does take a little bit of controversy to build a sport up in America. Of course, F1's dropped its American Grand Prix and its American driver, so it's a limited amount of usefulness to it now until it gets an American Grand Prix back.
But they have got more coverage in the media, with like the BBC News are always talking about Formula One now where they didn't before, which is a good thing. But then I think a lot of fans are turned off by it. So it's like 50-50, really.
Absolutely. I mean, everyone always makes the quote, there's no such thing as bad publicity, or all publicity is good publicity. And I think what they overlook is that it was Adolf Hitler that coined that phrase.
Yes.
Okay, moving on from that question, the next thing to ask you then is, do you see Fernando Alonso moving on from McLaren to another team in 2008? And if so, which team might that be?
Well, on the face of it, you'd have to say Fernando Alonso's position at McLaren must be untenable. I mean, the enormously difficult thing that Ron Dennis and McLaren have to deal with over the final three races, along with everything else, is making sure that no one thinks that Fernando Alonso has been disadvantaged in any way, because certainly a lot of people expect that's going to happen, given Alonso's rows with Dennis that are now public, his demands to be made number one, which weren't met, and of course the fact that he threatened to go to the FIA with the emails that ultimately landed McLaren in trouble. On the surface of that, you'd have to say Alonso has surely lost some popularity within McLaren. Dennis would surely want to rid himself of the headache and get rid of Alonso in whichever direction possible. So where could Alonso go? Plenty of people have suggested that he would end up at Renault. That would certainly be logical, but they've not had a very competitive car this year, and it remains to be seen what Briatore could do to persuade Alonso that he could win the championship in a 2008 Renault. There's obviously teams like, you know, Toyota and so on, but I honestly don't think he'd give them a second look or even a first look, because they're nowhere. A lot of people have said that Luca Montezemolo's dream lineup at Ferrari is Raikkonen and Alonso. That's certainly possible, but given Alonso's apparent newfound appetite for being the number one in a team, he might not want to go to Ferrari and have to deal with Raikkonen. So I think perhaps the other alternative is that he would take a sabbatical or even quit the sport. I mean, he did say last year at one point that he wasn't interested in winning more than about three world championships. Well, if he was world champion this year, maybe he'd quit.
That's an interesting idea, and I have heard a number of people say that. The only question I raise to that statement is, Bernie has planned two Spanish Grand Prix next year. Can you see Bernie letting Alonso leave? Will he be allowed to take a sabbatical?
What could Eccleston threaten him with, I guess, is the response to that question. If Alonso's, you know, going to take his ball away and not play anymore, then can't stick him in a car and make him, you know. I dare say it's not the sort of thing where money's going to be a motivating factor. He's already earned plenty of it, and it doesn't seem to have been an issue in the past. You know, if he's genuinely not interested in doing this long term, then I don't see what Eccleston could do about it in those circumstances. In all honesty, what do I expect him to do? That's a really difficult question. I would expect him, if an opportunity came up to have a championship winning car that's not a McLaren, I would expect Alonso to take it. But if there's no entry into Ferrari and the Renault for next year doesn't look good, then you never know, we may end up seeing him stay at McLaren. After all, Prost did stay at McLaren in 1989, and many people expected him to leave.
That's an interesting insight. That is very true. And also, McLaren have the single ECU. They are the ECU supplier for 2008, so they should have a pretty big advantage over the opposition.
Yeah, that's a whole different kettle of fish, that, isn't it? I mean, that looked, yes, last year when that decision was made, it seemed a little bit odd that it was a McLaren-related company, but they are a company that have an enormous amount of experience in producing engine control units and similar things in motorsports, and no one really, I think, thought all that much of it. But now this year, with all the espionage stuff coming out, then people are inclined to look at that in a very different light, and less favourably.
So we don't take up any more Keith's time, then let's just throw one more question at him.
Who do you think is going to win, Alonso or Hamilton?
Or Raikkonen.
No, he's not going to win.
Looking at the last three races, obviously we've got Fuji next, and that's a little bit of an unknown quantity, but I expect McLaren to go fairly well there because it's got a great big long straight and a lot of very slow corners. And I don't think, well, I think that will suit McLaren's short wheelbase chassis better than Ferrari's longer wheelbase chassis based on what we've seen so far this year. That seems to be the way it's gone. So I think one of the McLaren drivers will win that race. And then even if Ferrari are going to win the last two races on circuits that suit them better, that's going to carry, I think, one of the McLaren drivers across the line and make him champion. Which one's it going to be? I think it's going to be Fernando Alonso because he's been here before. You know, he's won two championships under phenomenal high-pressure circumstances, particularly last year's with Michael Schumacher. He's got the experience of doing it. He's only 2 points behind Hamilton. I think if Hamilton beats Alonso to it, then we're going to find ourselves talking about Hamilton in terms of him being one of the sport's greats far sooner than we expected to. But where would I put my money right now? Fernando Alonso. Incidentally, I hate it when people get asked questions like that and don't give an answer. Who do you two think are going to win?
I think Alonso, because the pressure's been getting more and more, and Alonso's been getting better and better whilst Hamilton's been dropping off a bit.
Absolutely.
I think I'm going to say the same thing, unless if something does happen to Alonso's car, there's going to be pressure from the FIA and presumably also from Ron to make sure that a similar accident would probably have to happen to Hamilton's in order to make it fair, and that might just let Raikkonen in.
It's not going to happen,
but I can't see. If say, by some fluke, Alonso's engine blew up at the next race.
Yeah, you have to say, neither of the McLarens have failed all year, and that either leads you to believe that they're not going to fail for the rest of the year, or that surely the law of averages states that, just like Michael Schumacher last year, one of their engines has got to go pop at an inconvenient moment or something like that, and Sod's law says that's going to be Alonso's engine.
Hamilton is as lucky as Schumacher.
He is, but
he's got the champion's luck, hasn't he? Yeah, he finds his way out of gravel traps.
If that does happen to Alonso, then what do McLaren do? Even if it genuinely is an accident, but it doesn't look like an accident, especially to the Spanish fans, what's their move?
It's down to preparation. You know, they've got to make sure, A, that the engine doesn't blow in the first place, and B, that if it does, they've got stacks and stacks of proof that proves that it was, you know, it wasn't someone pressing the engine destruct button.
That sounds like a good place to leave it. Thank you, Keith.
Thanks very much. It's been a pleasure to be on here. I hope you'll have me back again sometime soon.
Absolutely.
Not more TED news. This isn't going to become a regular feature, is it?
Oh, I do hope it is.
After the Belgian Grand Prix, TED wrote in his notebook on ITV F1's website, "You may have heard the Super Aguri Honda rumour that was going round at Spa. It was to the effect that Honda Racing was so scared that Super Aguri would beat them that they somehow prevented their sister team from bringing to the race aerodynamic parts that had been tested successfully in Spa 2 months ago. A quick conversation I had with the Aguri team boss, Daniel Ordetto, keeps coming back to me. Significantly, Daniel ended our chat with the admission that his team are not in control of all the parts they run on the car."
Ooh, now, early in the year, I think we talked about the fact that there was a rumour that Honda may require Super Aguri to turn their engine down in order to be less competitive, or at least not get the latest updates. Presumably, you could prove that with some of the audio sampling tools that the teams have, and I guess they decided not to go that route, and maybe they'd restrict them in some other way.
That kind of leads me to talk about a column I was reading in F1 Racing this week.
You've done a lot of reading this week.
I know, it only landed on the doormat this morning, and I've read it all the way through already. How cool is that? Anyway, Peter Windsor's column, it starts like this. The T word was used for the first time in the F1 team principals meeting in Turkey. T as in team, as in F1 team championship, not F1 constructors championship, team championship. Can you believe that? He goes on to say that while Super Aguri and Toro Rosso are purchasing their cars, at least they do have people working on them, whilst next year ProDrive are really not. I thought it was an interesting point that ProDrive are purely planning to buy the car and run it and not bother with the building of it at all.
They're going
to
leave it to the parent team to keep it up to date, aren't they?
Yeah. The column ends with, "If that is good for F1, then I'm a rabid soccer fan."
Right.
"Better by far for Richards to use his excellent facilities, huge resources and talented personnel to do what F1 people should want to do in the first place, and that is to build his own cars."
Yes, except it's prohibitively expensive to do that, and possibly he doesn't have the budget which would allow him to follow that route.
Says he has huge resources.
He has a great team and a very large factory. I guess it depends on which sponsors he's lined up and how much budget he's been allocated to run for the year.
Well, that is our talking point for this week. What do you think about customer cars? Should they be allowed constructors' points, or should it be called a team championship?
It's an interesting idea, that. But where's the incentive for anyone to build their cars in the future?
Last week's talking point, we asked you about the Alonso Hamilton incident at the first corner of Spa, and we had some interesting responses on the blog. Don Speak English said, while Alonso was a bit robust, it's a bit bloody cheeky of Hamilton to be complaining about it, as it's the sort of behaviour he's been at most of the season, which is a fair point. FT said, I don't agree. While I reckon Lewis has been having Schumi-esque attack angles at his starts, he really hasn't pushed any other driver aggressively into the grass, and when another driver has answered, he hasn't complained about it.
That can't be all, FT said.
Yeah.
It normally goes on for pages.
It was quite a short response this time.
Okay.
And Rich said, both Alonso and Hamilton are drivers not adverse to pushing and shoving. For some people, these manoeuvres are either brilliant driving or blatant intimidation, depending which driver you support. Both drivers are fighting for the championship, and while Alonso's move looked rather more blatant, if the roles were reversed, would Hamilton have done the same? I'm afraid the answer would be yes.
That is a very, very fair point. And it may just be the way the camera angles have caught it, but thus far, I think Lewis has been slightly more subtle about how he goes about pushing people off the track, whereas Alonso wasn't subtle at all, and clearly the viewers at home picked up on that. It's sure going to be an interesting last three races, isn't it?
Leave a comment on the blog at sidepodcast.com, join the discussions at formula1.net, or phone us on 012128TRACK. Next week is the Japanese Grand Prix, the 30th of September at Fuji. The track is 2.852 miles long, which will be 67 laps, and the previous three winners... Oh, hang on a minute. There were only two previous winners. In 1977, it was James Hunt, and in 1976, it was Mario Andretti.
Well, I know nothing about this track, as it was way before my time. Although I can say when I first started playing arcade games, there used to be a sitting simulator, and that track was Fuji. That was a lot of fun.
The pictures look very pretty, that's all I can tell you.
There's a mountain in the background, yeah. Mount Fuji.
Very picturesque.